Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. Well, it seems like it's taken forever, and it has, but we're finally heading down the home stretch. 2 weeks to go before November 3rd, but one more way in which this election is so different. Over 27 million Americans have already cast their ballots, and 95% of those who still haven't voted say they've already made up their mind and are not about to change. So Donald Trump and Joe Biden are both still running around the country, aiming to persuade those few undecided voters, yes, but mainly working to energize their base to get out and vote. Even veteran political correspondents say that for many reasons, they've never seen an election like this one before. Even veteran political correspondents like Dan Balls, chief correspondent for The Washington Post, who's been a political correspondent for The Post since 1978 and has written several books on presidential campaigns. We caught up with Dan Balls this week to get his take on where things stand on campaign 2020 with just 2 weeks to go. Hello, Dan. Good to talk to you again. Been a while.
Hello, Bill. Nice to talk to you. Yes, it has been a while.
Yeah, so let me ask you, you've covered a lot of presidential campaigns. Have you ever covered one anywhere near this one or like this one?
No, for, 100 reasons, Bill, but I mean, primarily because of the nature of the stakes in this campaign, A, and B, the degree to which COVID-19 has affected every aspect of the campaign. This is certainly the first presidential campaign I've covered from my own house, which is a great frustration, frankly, but it is what it is.
For you, it's kind of the old front porch strategy, I guess. Right?
Yeah, it's not an ideal way to do it. I mean, there's a lot that one can do from, a telephone, but there's things you can't do from a telephone. And that's the one piece of covering this campaign that, I mean, it's both frustrating, but I think it just kind of limits what you feel, I mean, the inability to be out in some of the battleground states and to have a chance to have conversations with people. Yeah. Polling is helpful, obviously. But personal conversations with people are also helpful, and you put the two together and, you sometimes come to a different sense of things than just from one versus the other.
So with roughly 2 weeks out, how do you see, since the lay of the land today, knowing that things might change, but how do you sense the lay of the land today?
Well, I talk about it from two different angles. One is, from the overall national perspective, mm-hmm. And that looks quite good for Biden, frankly. I mean, his lead in the national polls is somewhere in the neighborhood of, 8 points or 9 points, depending on kind of which polls you put into the bucket to do the averaging. We've not seen a campaign like that. We've not seen a margin like that for quite some time. I mean, the best Barack Obama did in 2008 was, 7 points? And in a highly polarized environment, you're just not expecting to get landslide numbers in a national poll. But again, mm-hmm. The national polls are national polls, and they tell you about the popular vote. You can try to extrapolate from national polls and say nobody's ever put together an electoral college majority losing the popular vote by 7, 8, 9 points. So you would say on that basis that Biden looks pretty good. If you flip it around and then look at it state by state, you can come up with a different perspective or conclusion. And that is that in the Sunbelt states that are most important to Trump and to Biden, which is to say Florida, North Carolina, and Arizona, the polls are very close. They're certainly seemingly within the margin of error, which means that Trump certainly has an opportunity to win those states again. And if he were to do that and hold, you know, everything else he held the last time, then he really only needs, you know, one of those three northern states, Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania, in order to win. So in that sense, you say, well, he still has a path. And people who say there's no path for him, I think are being overly, you know, overly optimistic about what might happen. You know, General Mally Dillon, who's the campaign manager for Vice President Biden, did a memo to donors that instantly leaked to everybody. And she made the point that that this is a closer race than some people might think. And I think some people probably said, well, she's just trying to, you know, avoid the issue of complacency, which she certainly was. But she, you know, she's a very savvy person and knows the state by state issues and knows that one thing that the polls are always a little bit squishy about is what is the actual composition of the overall electorate.
Right.
And likely voter screens can, you know, can help on that, but they're somewhat imprecise.
I saw on CNN this morning that they looked at the 10 states, swing states, battleground states, whatever you want to call them, that Trump won in 2016 by 10 points or less. In eight of them, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, and Iowa, Joe Biden leads by anything from 1% in Iowa to 8% in Michigan. The other two, Ohio, they're tied, and this is the average for these states of all the polls. In Ohio, they're tied, and in Texas, Donald Trump is up by 1%. So, as you say, that could change, right? But at this point, even in the battleground states, Donald Trump's got some work to do.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, he clearly is having to defend some places that, you know, a year or 2 years ago, you would have said he would not have to defend. I mean, Ohio looked like it had moved pretty decisively into his column in 2016, and that was likely to hold, that the suburban strength that Hillary Clinton demonstrated in Ohio was more than offset by the rural strength that Trump had demonstrated, and that, you know, an 8-point margin in a state that we've always considered, you know, as my friends in Ohio like to say, considered the decider state, a true battleground. It looked like it wasn't necessarily a true battleground. Similarly, in Iowa, which through most of the campaigns since 2000 has been a quite competitive state. Trump did very well there. I think he won it by 9 points, somewhere between 9 and 10, 4 years ago, and that too is a battleground. Texas, I wrote about Texas over the weekend as to me the most intriguing state in the country right now, simply because if Texas were to flip to Biden, it would crush any opportunity for Trump to win re-election. I mean, with the number of electoral votes that Texas has, that would break the back of the Trump campaign, and it is clearly competitive right now. I don't know whether it's a 1-point margin for Trump or a 3-point margin for Trump, but it's, you know, it doesn't appear to be the kind of margin you would expect. He won that state by 9 points 4 years ago, which is a comfortable amount, but it's less than any Republican had won it in a long, long time. So the fact that he is having to defend Ohio, Iowa, maybe even Texas, although I don't think either Trump or Biden is putting real money into that state simply because it's so costly. And even with all the money they've got, they got to put their money where it counts first. But yes, he's got work to do and in more places than they would certainly want to have 2 weeks out.
What do you attribute as the deciding factor or factors in the way the polls look today? Is there any one issue that cuts through, or is it, as you know, our mutual friend Jonathan Martin from the New York Times suggests, it's Trump's personality that's the issue, or is it his record for 4 years, or just the fact that Joe Biden's not Hillary Clinton?
Well, I, you know, Bill, I think it's in some ways all of those. You know, Jonathan's right that a lot of this has to do with the president's personality and his behavior. And I think that's one reason why the polls have been relatively stable for a fairly long period of time. Mm-hmm. Most people made up their minds some time ago what they thought about this president and whether they thought he deserved a second term or not. And those people really haven't budged in any notable way for, you know, maybe a couple of years. So there's that. The fact that Biden is not Hillary Clinton is certainly a factor. The Trump campaign has, you know, has done everything it could think of to try to demonize Biden, and it has not had the effect that they had hoped. In some polls, Biden's favorability rating has actually gone up a bit over the course of this campaign, which is kind of unheard of when you think of, you know, modern campaigns, that if mm-hmm. somebody unloads, you know, tens of millions of dollars of negative advertising on somebody, it usually drives up their negative numbers. And it hasn't had that effect. I mean, Biden is just a different politician than Hillary Clinton. She came into that campaign, obviously, with 2 decades of attacks on her and her husband, and therefore a lot of baggage, and she was not able to get out from under that. Biden didn't suffer from that going in and has been able mm-hmm. to avoid it. But I think the third factor, and as we've looked at our polls over the last 2 months, really, The coronavirus pandemic is a big problem for Trump. One of the things that Scott Clement, our polling director, and Emily Guskin, who's the number two in that unit, have looked at in most of our polls is the people who have a favorable impression of the way Trump has handled the economy and a negative impression of the way he has handled the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And those people net out in favor of Biden, which is to say, for those people, the coronavirus issue seems to be more important in making their voting decision than does the economy. So I think it's all of those factors together. But a lot of it just has to do with people made a judgment on Trump a long time ago, and they haven't changed.
Yeah. They may also tie the coronavirus and the economy together, right?
Well, they do, yes.
Meaning the economy suffered because of the way Trump has handled the coronavirus. I haven't seen the interior of your polling, but just...
Yeah, although I think some people say the economy suffered because this state or another state shut down the economy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some people do accept the idea that Trump is not solely responsible for what has happened to the economy, other than that his handling of the pandemic has made it difficult for the economy to rebound as fast as he claims it is rebounding.
Right. So on those issues that you and I talked about that are factors, I was struck this morning. You probably got the same tweet or saw it that I did. When I woke up and looked at my phone, there was a tweet from Donald J. Trump talking about Hunter Biden and Hunter Biden and Ukraine. And I told you he was guilty, and now this proves that he's guilty. I mean, it's kind of like beating an old drum, isn't it? I mean, is that really going to turn things around for him? Does he believe it will?
I don't know whether he believes it will, but he certainly is trying to make it an issue, and I suspect trying to set it up to talk about it in the debate on Thursday night.
Yeah. But he's been trying a long time.
He has been trying a long time. They have been trying a long time, and it hasn't, you know, it hasn't had any real impact. It's hard to believe that that the son of the former vice president and whatever business dealings he had, and whatever people may think about the, you know, whether it was appropriate or not, and even Hunter Biden has said in retrospect it was not, that is going to be the issue that decides the presidential election. I think we're dealing with historic problems right now. And it's hard to believe that Hunter Biden is going to break through in a way that changes the minds of people who are, you know, who may be undecided at this point. Certainly, mm-hmm. it energizes Trump's most loyal supporters, but they've been quite energized with or without the Hunter Biden issue. So I don't know, but he is doing everything he can to kind of try one more time to put it into play in the last 2 weeks. I mean, maybe he thinks this is, you know, the 2020 version of the, you know, of the Comey intervention in the last couple right. of weeks of the campaign 4 years ago. But seemingly this is different.
So if you look at the 2 weeks left, roughly, Donald Trump's got to turn this around. So my question is, can he turn it around? And is this week's debate such an opportunity?
The debate is an opportunity, but every opportunity he has had, he's squandered. He had an opportunity in the first debate, and he chose to, you know, have a strategy in which, you know, he came off as confrontational, bombastic, combative, belligerent, you know, pick the adjective. But it was something that, I mean, I've talked to some Republican strategists who said before that debate, they seemed to be seeing a little bit of traction that Trump was getting. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, mm-hmm. at the margins, but that he was getting it. And that and then the fact that he contracted COVID-19 just seemed to kind of stop that. So he had another opportunity in the town hall meeting last week that was on NBC. And Savannah Guthrie turned out to be a very, you know, a very tough interrogator. Right. And he chose to, you know, pick a series of fights with her. And again, in a way that it just doesn't help him. Everything he's doing is reinforcing kind of what people think about him. I don't know whether it's possible at this point for him to do something that changes people's minds. Let's say he comes in Thursday night with a kind of totally different personality, much calmer, more, yeah. more reflective, perhaps self-deprecating, in which he acknowledges that he's made mistakes, you know, just, you know, kind of across the board, a different Donald Trump. I'm not sure that's possible. You know, after 4 years, we've seen that he doesn't change. He didn't change from when he was a candidate to when he became president, as some people thought he might. He hasn't changed as president. So will we see a different Donald Trump Thursday night? I'd be very surprised.
You mean we're still waiting for the pivot?
right.
Well, there's one other way that that Donald Trump, I think, believes that he can turn this around, and that is his daily campaign rallies, which Jason Miller, one of his top aides, said are soon going to be not just one a day, but two or three campaign rallies a day. I mean, to what extent are these in any way expanding Donald Trump's base or reaching out to people he doesn't already have?
Well, the quote unquote secret weapon that they may or hope to have is that they are going to hope to turn out people, particularly in those battleground states, who were Trump-like supporters in 2016, but who didn't vote. So that what that means is that in those, you know, in those outlying areas, not the cities and the suburbs, obviously, but in the exurbs, in the small towns, in the rural areas, that they drive those margins higher than they were 4 years ago, and that they drive the raw turnout higher. And if they can do that, then you do change the composition of the electorate. Then you have a different balance between, you know, kind of Trump world and Biden world in terms of geography and types of voters. So, you know, give the president credit. I mean, he does have seemingly a tremendous amount of stamina and energy, even after having, you know, had the coronavirus. And in down the stretch in 2016, he was going to more places than Hillary Clinton was. He was, you know, his days were longer and his rallies were more boisterous, enthusiastic. And I think he knows that that helped turn the tide in the last few weeks, 4 years ago, and maybe it will this time. I don't know that he knows anything else to do. And so he's going to do it. And so we'll see whether it's different this time.
And we're talking with Dan Balls, the chief correspondent for The Washington Post, here on the Bill Press Pod. We haven't talked about the Joe Biden campaign yet. When we come back, we'll catch up with Dan and get his take on how Joe Biden's doing. And today's podcast with Dan Balls of The Washington Post, brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers, 1.7 million strong and over 3,000 local affiliates across the country. Teachers helping kids and parents get the best education possible in these difficult times due to COVID-19, in-person teaching, online teaching, the hybrid teaching, and including 80,000 early childhood teachers. We salute the members of the AFT under President Randy Weingarten, thank them for the great work they're doing, and thank them for the support of the Bill Press Pod.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back with Dan Balls from the Washington Post. So, Dan, I do have to ask you, before we talk about the Biden campaign, what about the fact that as of this morning, 28 million Americans have already voted? We've never seen that before, for sure, right?
It's rather astonishing, isn't it? I mean, when you look at the number of people who are voting, I talked to somebody who's very smart about data and, you know, stuff last week about this. And I said, can we draw any conclusions about this? And this person said, not yet. And the reason is many states have changed the rules on early voting. There's more early voting available today than there was 4 years ago. And we know that many more people are voting by mail, and that in some states it's easier to vote by mail than it has been. So any comparison to what was going on 4 years ago is kind of an apples and oranges. We don't know whether it's simply, you know, we're just moving forward when everybody votes, and that at a point in this early voting period, things will slow down dramatically, and we'll have what we've always seen, which is, you know, X number of people voting, they just happen to vote earlier, mm-hmm. or whether this represents some kind of a surge. Now, you know, I know that Michael McDonald, who runs the U.S. Election Project, believes that we're going to have record turnout. And I think he's not the only one. If you talk to pollsters in different states, everything they have been seeing for many months has told them that the turnout is going to be quite large this time. But it is quite amazing to see the, you know, the lines of people waiting to vote, yeah, and the number of ballots that have been requested and the number of ballots that have already been turned in. Right. And it's not just in one place. It's in all kinds of places.
And certainly those are people that they're in the bank, right? One way or the other, those votes are in the bank. These are not people that can still be persuaded to change their mind. So the audience, the available audience to pick up votes shrinks, right?
It does. I mean, a couple of things to say about that. One is we know that there weren't that many truly undecided voters, you know, at the start, mm-hmm, of this fall season. So that's one thing. And I think what we're not clear about is whether the people who are voting are people who knew how they were going to cast their ballot, you know, 6 months ago, and just have been waiting for the opportunity to do it and don't want to take any chances of waiting too long. Whether the Biden or the Trump campaigns are banking people who were undecided but suddenly became decided and decided to vote early, I don't know the answer to that. But as you're right, every vote that's been cast is a vote that's not going to change. Now, one, mm-hmm, you know, one question about mail ballots in particular is spoilage. There are rules in every state on, right, what you have to do, mm-hmm, with your ballot, and if you mess it up, that vote will not
count.
In some states, you have an opportunity to correct it, but not in every state, as I understand it.
Right. So let's talk about the Biden campaign. We've talked a lot about the Trump campaign. Joe Biden's run a very different kind of campaign for a long time, staying in his basement. Now he's out and about, but in a very limited fashion. There's a lot of social distancing, you know, this drive-in with his cars kind of thing, and raising a ton of money online. How often, you know, just you've seen a lot of campaigns. How do you rate his campaign for adjusting to the times, let's say?
Well, they have done this, I think, for two reasons. Starting out, I think the main reason that they kept him at home was to, you know, protect him as much as possible from contracting the coronavirus, mm-hmm, which, you know, for somebody who's as old as he is, he's obviously in a high risk category. And the less exposure he has, the less he is out, the less the risk that he's going to contract COVID-19. So I think that was part of it. And I think then what they discovered was, well, you know what? Staying at home is not hurting him. So why suddenly, you know, succumb to, you know, the beating of drums of nervous Democrats who say he's got to get out there, he's got to campaign, he's got to be everywhere. You know, just kind of hold the line and see how things go. Obviously, he's felt the need to be out more than he was prior, mm-hmm, to, let's say, Labor Day, and they have stepped that up. But as you say, it's certainly a more limited kind of out campaigning in person than the president is doing. And I think, again, for health and safety reasons, but also they have tried to use the campaign to kind of model what they think is behavior that is, you know, that is in contrast to the president, as a way of reinforcing the idea that if he becomes president, he would be a better steward of dealing with the, mm-hmm, pandemic than Trump has been. So I think it's all of those factors. But right, but a big one certainly is to keep him safe.
And also, a very impressive $383 million he raised in September, unprecedented, and actually has raised more money than Donald Trump and has more money in the bank than Donald Trump does at this point.
Yeah, $383 million last month on top of $364 or $5 the previous month. I mean, it's just it's amazing the amount of money that has flowed into that campaign. And that has completely turned upside down what everybody assumed would be a major Trump advantage on money in the fall, because Biden during the primaries struggled to raise money,
Oh, yeah.
Bernie Sanders was raising money easily, as were any number of other candidates. And Biden was, you know, I mean, flat on his back in terms of money in that period right after Iowa and New Hampshire. So for this to suddenly, you know, just these buckets of dollars that are falling onto the top of the campaign, I think surprises everybody and gives them an advantage that they didn't think they would have. Their ability now to outspend Trump on television is quite significant. And whatever you think of the value of TV advertising in a presidential campaign, I don't think it's as decisive as it, as some people might think. But nonetheless, it's better to have the opportunity to spend than not. But we're seeing it in other, you know, we're seeing it in other Democratic campaigns. I mean, $57 million that went into Jamie Harrison's Senate campaign in
right.
South Carolina, and the amount of money that Mark Kelly has raised in his Senate campaign in Arizona. I mean, it just there is an enthusiasm in grassroots Democratic places that people are just sending money to these campaigns.
So, Dan, I want to close by asking you a couple of forward-looking questions. First, if he were to lose, it's too early to write the history books, but how do you think we will judge the Trump presidency?
Well, I think right now it would be judged harshly. I mean, it would be judged harshly for all of the things we know about the way he has conducted himself and the way he has, you know, put at risk certain Democratic institutions or certainly attempted to weaken them. I think that would be a quite harsh judgment. If on top of that, he loses and becomes a one-term president, that would add to that. Mm-hmm. One-term presidents, not all one-term presidents are judged as failures, but I think that for Trump, it would be a double blow. There aren't many presidents who lose after one term if they are in the first term for their party in the White House. I mean, George H.W. Bush lost after a term, but that was in essence the third consecutive term for the Republicans. This is the first term for the Republicans, and if Trump were to lose it, that would go against history. So I would think that he would be judged harshly. I guess one question would be whether, in many, many years out into the future, some of the things he has done, which is to say the harsher line the tougher line with China, would be judged to have been an effective and smart change on the part of U.S. policy. There may be some things like that that in mm-hmm. retrospect people would judge differently. But I think overall, he will have a tough judgment from historians.
And looking the other way, were he to win, what do you think, from what we know of him, a Biden presidency would look like?
I don't know the answer to that, Bill, because we don't know quite how Biden will deal, A, with the pandemic, which clearly will still be with us, even if there is the vaccine that is beginning to be used, how he will do with the economy, and how he will manage a Democratic coalition in which there is still a division between the center-left and the left.
Right.
And the pressure that he is going to feel in terms of putting forward the actual policies. I mean, it's relatively easy in a campaign to, you know, kind of satisfy everybody. And what we've seen so far in the fall is that he's been tougher on the left. I mean, he's emphasized how he beat Bernie Sanders and he beat the left.
Right.
To obviously as a way to try to win white working class voters in November. But if he becomes president, that's going to be a battle that he's going to have to, have to navigate. And that's not always that easy. Also, these are very big problems that he's going to inherit. And so, you know, it's one thing to win an election against a, you know, an opponent who's clearly vulnerable. And another thing then to be the president who has to deal simultaneously with, you know, with the pandemic, with an economy that's struggling to come back, with expectations among Black voters that there will be something different than they have gotten in the past or seen in the past from Democratic presidents. And then, you know, just the question of, you know, how he assembles the cabinet and how he deals with, you know, a Democratic House and perhaps a Democratic Senate, and how much he'll need Republican votes to do some of the things he wants to do. So it's an enormous challenge that he would take on if he becomes the president.
And again, were Trump to lose, what happens, do you believe, to the Republican Party? Is it the Trump Party forever, or do you think there will be a comeback from, let's call them, mainstream Republicans?
Well, that's the battle that will be waged, Bill, and we know that that's going to happen, in a sense, whether he wins or loses. I mean, if he wins, it embeds Trumpism more deeply into the Republican Party. But there will be a battle for the nomination in 2024 that will include people from different parts of the party. But if he loses, I think that that becomes more intense. And I think that the kind of the non-Trump wing of the Republican Party becomes more emboldened. But Trumpism isn't, you know, I don't think Trumpism goes away. If he loses, there will be, you know, there will be people who will say, let's make it go away. But right. but there are a lot of people who still believe in what Trump has done. And there's a part of the Republican coalition that is very, very much, you know, devoted to kind of the way Trump did things. So that will be a huge battle. And if he loses, it'll start almost immediately.
Right. And of course, Donald Jr. is out there probably thinking that he's the heir to that, to the Trump party.
Well, you know, it's hard to imagine that Donald Trump is going to disappear.
That's exactly. But who do you think would, who do you see as the potential, at least, leader of the anti-Trump forces, or the Trump to get back to mainstream Republicanism? Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse?
Well, I don't think Mitt Romney has aspirations to run for president at this point.
Right.
I mean, he's clearly a voice who will be arguing in favor of a non-Trump or even an anti-Trump approach. But, you know, perhaps Ben Sasse, you know, maybe a Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland.
There you go. Right.
You know, there will be some people, but they're going to have to be, you know, they'll be somewhat tentative, I suspect, in how they do it, because they don't want to completely kind of disqualify themselves. I mean, you want to have if you have an anti-Trump message, you want to have it in a way that perhaps still brings in some of the people who have been supporting Trump.
You've been very generous with your time. For the last question, I want to circle back to where we started, kind of, that we've never seen an election like this one for several reasons. So this campaign is so different. Looking forward, Dan, in terms of how people campaign, how they raise money, how conventions are held, do you think campaigns are going to be a lot different in the future than they have been?
Well, I think they will be different. I mean, I think the conventions showed that there is another way to do something that, you know, that has clearly become a kind of a tired tired form.
You and I have been to so many of them.
Yeah, although frankly, there's also some value of having everybody together. I mean, it just there's something of that. So my guess is that there would be some kind of a hybrid in terms of conventions. I think that everybody has learned that there are things you can do virtually that are quite efficient in campaigning. And so my guess is that the experience of this year has taught people that they don't have to be stuck in the old ways, and that innovation and creativity is certainly available, and that technology and people's use of social media and all kinds of things makes it more likely that we'll see campaigns that are somewhat different in the future.
Yep. And hopefully we will not have to cover them from our own home or our own front porch. Dan Balls, great to spend time with you. 2 weeks to go. And whatever happens, we'll have politics will roll on and on. And so you and I will still have a day job to do.
Exactly. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great. And that's it for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to the Bill Press Pod if you haven't already done so. You know how to do it. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, just pull up Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe, and you are in. Meanwhile, stay strong, stay safe, stay sane, and above all, get out and vote. Our democracy depends on it. And we'll see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.